This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award. Are you doing excellent research that deserves recognition? The NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award recognizes bold young researchers who ask fundamental questions at the intersection of the life and social sciences. Researchers who take risks to address relevant and exciting questions with creative approaches, regardless of the research outcome. Submissions are due May 15th. Visit science.org/NOMIS, that's N-O-M-I-S, to apply today. This is the Science Podcast for October 7th, 2022. I'm Sarah Crespi. Each week we talk about the most interesting news and research from Science and the sister journals. First up this week, staff writer Rodrigo Perez Ortega. He joins me to discuss links between violent conflict in Myanmar and a boom in fossil amber research. Also on the show this week, we talk about how bacterial spores, which can lie dormant for millions of years, how these spores decide it's time to wake up with researcher Kaito Kikuchi. And in a sponsored segment from our custom publishing office, director of custom publishing, Sean Sanders, talks with Ramon Parsons about the goals and mission of the Tisch Cancer Institute at the Icon School of Medicine. Now we have Rodrigo Perez Ortega. He's a staff news writer for Science. We're going to talk about the ethics of research and publication on materials obtained from a conflict zone in Myanmar. These are incredibly old fossils trapped in amber, but the amber is considered a gemstone, so it can be moved outside the country, whereas fossils are restricted. But with the fossils inside the amber, these gemstones are extremely valuable and provide income to whichever faction in the conflict controls the mines. Hi, Rodrigo.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. This story is something I really have a lot of attachment to. I actually went to China and spoke to a bunch of researchers about working with this amber, these fossils in the amber, and it's such an interesting field and it is really fraught. So let's get into it. So let's talk a little bit about the fossils here. These are in amber and they're very old. Can you talk about what kind of research is done with these fossils?
Right. So these fossils that are trapped in this amber are 99 million years old. That's when dinosaurs roamed the Earth. This is the height of the Cretaceous period. And this is very special because other amber deposits around the world are much more younger, like the Baltic, Dominican Republic. And this is just kind of like a screenshot of the dinosaur habitat at that time. People find mostly insects because, you know, they're in the trees and then the sap traps them. Insects, wood, other plants, and sometimes they have found, which are the most impressive, little tiny like vertebrates, either lizards, amphibians, and parts of dinosaurs. So they found, you know, it made a lot of headlines. They found a little tail of a dinosaur in 2016, and it had feathers on it.
This really visualized it. It gave you that 3D embedded. Like, you know, if you've ever seen amber with a fly in it, this is that, but 100 million years old.
Exactly. So, you know, usually you find bones and you make interpretations of, especially the soft tissue that is usually lost to time. But like, this is just like a screenshot, like they were frozen in time. So they give a lot of detail to scientists about how things used to be at the time.
This is in Myanmar. This is all kind of coming out of the same ancient forest. But unfortunately, as interesting as the science is, and as it has helped give us better insight into this really amazing period of time, studying amber that is mined in Myanmar, you know, it's been really an ethical minefield for paleontologists, for publishers. What is some of the controversy there?
Right. So this really got into people's minds, especially researchers, back in 2019, when Science ran a feature story by Josh Sokol about this very problem. All these new papers coming out, especially from Chinese researchers, looking at this Myanmar amber. Myanmar has been embedded in this armed conflict ever since they got independence from the British. And so there's a lot of infighting, especially where this amber is mined, which is Kachin State. And in the past decade, I guess, a lot of this amber is being transported outside Myanmar to China, especially in these markets in Taichung. And that's where private collectors, paleontologists buy this amber to do research, right? So it's really, really hard to get into these mines, and the researchers themselves are looking for this amber, which is usually done with like fossils or other types of materials, right? You go into the field, you excavate, you document everything.
There's this pipeline from where the mines are in a conflict zone into markets, and then people are buying it and using it for research. There's some questions about provenance, like has it been, you know, obtained ethically if it's coming from this area where people are fighting?
Exactly. So one part, you know, the more scientific part, I guess, is just in order to be the most accurate possible, nowadays you really need to, you know, in papers state where the material came from. And the more detail you have, the more valid or more helpful it will be. So if you say, oh, I bought it in a market, I'm not sure exactly where it came from. Well, that's not as helpful as saying, oh, we collected these specimens in such and such locations, you know, GPS locations, and these are the strata, you know, to know exactly how old this is. On the one part, you know, the more scientific part. But on the other part, you know, this is a billion-dollar business, the amber trade from Myanmar. So you have the military and the independent army fighting in Kachin State. The side that controls the mine is going to benefit from this trade. I think this whole ethical issue erupted when the military took control of the mines in 2017. And then a United Human Rights Council fact-finding mission found that the military were guilty of genocide and crime against humanity in these mines. So suddenly the amber trade became unethical and problematic. Paleontologists suddenly realized that they buying this amber in these markets was potentially fueling all these human rights violations and conflict in Myanmar. And that, of course, you don't want that, right?
No. And then you talk about this paper in your story showing this link very clearly between amber research and how it may have benefited the conflict. How did they actually quantify this?
Although people knew about this conflict for many years now, there was no direct evidence that research on this amber was kind of like linked to these human rights violations or that was funding these kind of atrocities. So in this new paper, researchers, they went and looked all the previous papers from the last century, I guess, from Myanmar amber and quantified it. So they basically found by looking at those papers, three things. So first, they found that the publications on Myanmar amber in paleontology, there were quite a few papers in the last century and in the beginning of the 2000s. And it kind of like rose steadily, but then in 2014, suddenly it skyrocketed. It was a very stark contrast. And a lot of these papers started coming out, and the record number was in 2020. So that was the first finding, to see how it boomed. And then correlate that with the political and the ethical issues that were on the same timeline, you know. So looking at when the military took control of the mines, also when Chinese amber mines tapped out, that means that Chinese researchers were looking to study amber from elsewhere. And, you know, it's right next door, it's Myanmar. And then also some other happenings that may have been causing an effect on these publications, which is the Society for Better Paleontology, calling out for a moratorium on publishing on this amber. This was in 2020, and then a stronger moratorium in 2021. So all these related to all these publications gives you a lot of information about what's been going on, right? Why this boom and what has happened since we know of these ethical issues. And this, it goes deeper. The whole problem with Myanmar amber is that it's classified as a gemstone. It's legal to export it and to sell it.
Unlike with fossils, it wouldn't necessarily be okay to take a fossil out of the country or an animal for research purposes, but to take amber is fine.
Exactly. So, you know, Myanmar also has laws on fossils that they have to stay in the country. You have to have permission to research them. But then when a fossil is entrapped in amber, so what do you do? So that's the amber trade, and paleontologists have taken advantage of this gray zone to get their hands on this amber that no doubt is really relevant for science. But then is it amber? Is it fossil? Is it both? How do you do it legally? And of course, with the conflict, it's really, really hard to enforce these laws.
And I can see it being hard for a scientist based in Myanmar to actually participate in this research.
And another really important finding was that virtually all of these papers, they don't include any local authors. So no Myanmar researcher or paleontologist has been working on amber from their country, which is very clear evidence that this type of research is what scientists call parachute science, you know, so basically doing research with material from another country, from the global south, doing research on it without the contribution of local authors. So I also found that from my reporting that even Chinese researchers and from elsewhere, like a German group also has teamed up with local researchers to get permissions to study the amber mines, but so far they have been denied. So yes, I mean, it's ironic that these local researchers can't even work studying this amber like on site in the mines, and even they can't get a hold of these expensive amber because it's getting, most of it is getting transported out of the country to China and elsewhere. So, you know, when I talked to one of them, Xing Mang Thing, he told me that there's no local expertise to study amber. So there are paleontologists who mainly work with mammals, like Cenozoic mammals, and also petrified wood, but there is really no one qualified to work on amber because there's no amber in the country they could work with. They would have to collaborate with someone outside or go somewhere else to get this expertise. And that's also what they're pushing for, you know, to like make these collaborations equitable. I think everybody agrees that new amber like shouldn't be bought. By new, I mean after 2017 with the military takeover the mines.
New amber, you know, stuff that's post this certain date. Yeah, I could see that not wanting to enter into markets and earn people money as well as research publications. But what about what's already in museums, what's already in collectors' hands? Could that still be part of this research effort?
I think, yes. People are wondering what to do with all the research that is already at collections or stored somewhere. And one of the researchers from China, Shuo Guan, who I talked to, she was like, well, with these new moratoriums and publishing rules, it's really, really hard to publish of this amber that I bought before 2017. But then she says, oh, I don't have permits or documentation to prove that I bought this or I collected this before 2017. So it's really hard to do that, you know. And there was a paper earlier this year that I saw that, you know, it had all these permits and worked with a local researcher. So I think it can be done. It's going to be much more difficult, but it can be done. And I think a lot of the researchers I talked to agree it's the right thing to do.
So this call for a moratorium on studies on this amber that the Society for Vertebrate Paleontology called for, does this study, is it able to show that the moratorium has had an effect?
So they did see a smaller number of publications in 2021 and even a smaller number in 2022, but you know, the numbers are up to the publication date of this year. So you can't really say like per year of 2022. But I think it's going to be more years tracking this to see really these moratoriums and the, I guess, ethical revolution in paleontology. Because, you know, this is not only amber from Myanmar. It has to do with fossils from Brazil and elsewhere from Morocco and the global south, basically. To really see if these moratoriums or this kind of like reckoning is really having an effect on research.
Thanks, Rodrigo.
Thank you, Sarah.
Rodrigo Perez Ortega is a staff news writer for Science. You can find a link to the story we discussed and some of the really very clear graphics describing this inflection point in the publication of AMBER papers at science.org/podcast. Stay tuned for my chat with Kaito Kikuchi. We talk about the ingenious way bacteria make a decision to come out of spore form. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Change your job and you might just change the world. For anyone who's looking to get ahead in or just plain get into science, there's no better, more trusted resource than Science Careers. And it's free. On our site, you can search career opportunities across all disciplines and levels, research potential employers, sign up to get job alerts via email, upload your resume or CV to the searchable database, or read career advice articles. There's no shortage of global problems today that science can't solve. Be part of the solution. Visit sciencecareers.org today. When conditions get harsh and survival gets iffy, some bacteria go dormant. They basically turn off the engines, mothball as much as possible, and wait for better days. When a bacterium goes quiet like this, it becomes a spore. It sporulates. And then there's little activity, very little. Not really any ATP or energy use. Enzymes are off. Water is excluded. DNA is locked down. Okay, so it's very quiet, very inactive. But how does a spore wake up then if it can't really use energy? You know, how does it start the cellular engines again after traveling through time in this inert form? This week in Science, Kaito Kikuchi and colleagues write about one way for spores to exit dormancy by kind of acting like a neuron getting ready to fire. Kaito is here to talk about it. Hi.
Hi, Sarah.
I really started to think about these spores as kind of like a spaceship traveling out in the universe.
Yeah.
You know, you go into that sleep mode so that you save energy for when you can start to explore some other new area of the universe.
Or you like the sci-fi angle.
I do like the sci-fi angle. Anyway, what makes bacterium decide to go dormant? What are some of the conditions that they're just like, you know what, this is enough for me?
Canonically, the way they decide is that there's just not enough food around for them to grow the normal way. That takes a lot of energy and needs a lot of food around. So when that's not around, what they do instead is to decide to make a very strongly dormant structure, like a supercell that is full of spore. It's kind of like how plants can bolt and make seeds when you don't water them enough or something like that.
If I can't take care of myself, I'm just going to protect myself as much as I can until I can do more things.
Yeah, that's correct.
Do we know how long a bacteria could stay dormant? Is there like a record?
A very long time. There's a paper that found spores from an amber fossil that's tens of millions of years old, and they're able to successfully make that spore come back to life. So at least many millions of years is the answer.
Amazing. So obviously these guys have to turn back on. Otherwise, what's the point? You're just dying, right? So you have to turn on. Something has to trigger this exit from the dormant state. This is also called germination. What are some of the examples of triggers for germination, for a spore deciding that it's time to get busy again?
The major signals that make spores to germinate are called germinants because they enable germination. And the major types of germinants are amino acids. So spores are looking for amino acids that are used as food. And they have specialized receptors on the surface of the spore that binds them. And that's how they detect amino acids. There are other more artificial ways to germinate spores, for example, by cooking them in extreme high pressure. But that's more like how we can burst them apart rather than a biological way of the spore deciding.
The question you're asking here is, if everything is turned off, everything is quiescent, basically, how can it be sensing the environment?
Exactly.
The other question or the other, I guess, behavior or phenomenon that really made me curious about this was how it almost has a memory or a cumulative sensing going on where there's something happens, it remembers that, and then it happens again, and then maybe then it will turn on. So there's this kind of like accumulation of sensing that it seems very odd for something that's supposed to be low energy, low work, can't make a lot of changes to the cell.
Right. So that's part of a discovery, too, that we found that spores are able to smartly assess whether a signal is a freak advent that just happened once versus events that happen reliably. And just as you said, Sarah, the spores are able to actually count these signals while they're still dormant and by all means kind of dead. And that was something that appeared really crazy to us. That something really interesting must be happening.
Yeah. If your computer is off on your desk and you turn the light on once, it doesn't care. But if you just kept turning the light on and off, it decides to wake up. Like, what is it doing?
Right. You know, you need to double tap to do something.
Exactly. So your focus was on looking at potassium levels inside the bacterium. You're focusing on channels that let them through, how much was in there, how much was on the outside. Why was this a particular target of interest for your work?
In our lab, we focus on ions and how they are very important to bacterial physiology. For example, in our other projects, we looked at how bacterial communities called biofilms talk to each other using potassium ion flux and kind of like primitive neurons. And we also learned from older papers that spores contain a lot of potassium, among other ions, and they seem to be released in the first event following germination exposure. So that allowed us to think of what if spores use these potassium storage as kind of a non-expensive way to calculate information and act on that as kind of like the first spark when you're trying to turn the keys in your car engine.
So this is a cheap way of doing it because you can just store ions statically and then what, slowly release them or quickly release them?
That's right. So once you store ions, opening the ion channel and letting the ions flow down the potential gradient is very easy, or you don't have to spend energy to do that. So it seemed like a very good candidate to look at that mechanism that might work working in these dormant spores.
What did you have to do to figure out if this was going on? We're talking about single cells. They're very tiny. They're kind of impenetrable in a lot of ways.
That is really true. We wanted to look at the spores at the single cell level. So we wanted to look at individual spores while they're trying to respond. So we combined microscopy to do that imaging part and then microfluidics that allows us to change the composition of the environment that the spores are sitting in very precisely. So that allowed us to flush in these germinants at very precise time points while the microscope is recording a movie of each spore. And then we're able to record the responses of the spores to these inputs.
Mm-hmm. So in a wild type, in an unaltered cell, if you give it a nutrient pulse, maybe it'll exit dormancy, maybe it won't. But if you give it a second nutrient pulse, then it's much more likely. So this is a memory accumulating, kind of saying, oh, yeah, it does look like the environment is different.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we call that signal integration, so that they're integrating these consequent signals over time and responding differently. They're kind of ignoring the first event, but they are remembering that first event. And whenever they sense the second event, they're like, oh, this is the second time. It means there's lots of food around. And then they're more likely to germinate.
You guys did so many experiments.
Yes.
You did, you know, genetics, you did microfluidics, you did microscopy, you did electrophysiology on these tiny cells.
Yeah, we recorded that the potential, yeah.
All right, so one of the things you had to do was some genetic manipulation here to kind of nail down that this is the process. So what did you have to knock out and what happened when you did that?
The first thing we thought of, like, can we knock out the potassium pump that the spore is using when it's being made to pump in potassium inside? So what if we break that pump, we expect spores to have less potassium inside. And then maybe that'll change the germination propensity. So we did that first. And then we found that, yeah, if you have less potassium inside, spores react to these inputs much sensitively. So that was the first indication that our idea that potassium is important in this signal integration was experimentally verified. So we actually had a mathematical model that we made up that predicted the wild type behavior. It said that potassium levels need to go below a certain threshold for the spores to germinate.
Then you actually were able to also visualize that using some of these sensitive dyes. Can you talk about those experiments?
Right. So I think this is the coolest part of our research, in that we visualize a lot of things happening at single cell level. And one of the workhorses in our lab is a dye called thioflavin T, or THT. And this stains cells as they become more and more electrochemically charged. So we can just look at this dye and see how charged these cells, or in my case, spores are.
What processes could you see by using this sensitive dye?
One of the key predictions that arise from our potassium experiments is that potassium is leaving the spore as the spore is experiencing these nutrient pulses, right? And potassium ions are positively charged. So if you lose positive charges, then the result must be that the spore is getting more and more negative. And we wanted to see if that's actually true. So we stained these spores with the THT charged dye. And while we're doing all these pulses and microscopy happening, we do see that the THT dye really stains the spores in a nice kind of stepwise manner as they experience these pulses. So when they release the potassium, then that translates into a rapid and very striking change in electrochemical potential.
This really is starting to sound a lot like what I remember about how neurons work, changing the potential across the membrane, that small steps can happen, it can integrate over time and eventually trigger something. Is really that similar?
Exactly right. Yeah. So it's funny that you say that, Sarah, because the mathematical model I kind of mentioned is from neuroscience. So it's called Integrate and Fire model, and it's developed to study neurons, but we're able to show that it also can help us understand these bacterial spores.
What is triggered here when this dormancy threshold, when this threshold is hit? What happens next?
I must say a caveat that we are still trying to understand what exact molecule stuff is happening, but we know that what happens next is the spore commits to germination. It's a no-go-back state that you can't go back to dormancy, and instead it'll degrade its protective layers, it's tried to rehydrate its core, and it'll repair its DNA and make its food and make it another copy of a cell again.
So what you found here is the signal saying the go, no-go sign. We're definitely going. We're definitely changing state, but the cascade, the next few steps need to be worked out.
Yeah, I think that's the next frontier of spore research.
The next frontier. That's great. Thank you for the science fiction callback.
Of course.
So the bacteria used in this study, Bacillus subtilis, is a classic. It's a model organism. Is it likely that other types of bacteria are using the same kind of mechanism to do sensing when they're in dormancy?
Not all bacteria make spores, but many of them do. A lot of them look at these same germinants. And then we know that potassium is the most abundant cation or positively charged ions in all sorts of cells. So I think it's pretty reasonable to expect that a lot of these spores, regardless of species, use a pretty similar ion-based decision-making system.
One of the things about dormant spores is that they're super hard to kill. And we also talked about cooking them to wake them up, subjecting them to high heat and pressure. And the reason people do that is because they want to reduce contamination. Is understanding this germination go, no-go sign, you know, is that going to be able to help reduce contamination or interact with spores in a way where we can clean up, get rid of them when we need to?
I think that's part of the interesting application that can arise from our research is that a lot of the resistance that spores have and why it's hard to kill a spore is because it is a spore. So can we make spores germinate while we're trying to kill them? So I can think of ways that, for example, we combine our research in making these spores more likely to germinate in combination with an antibiotic dosage. So then we're kind of waking them up in the presence of toxins, and then therefore they're more likely to be removed by the treatment.
That's great. This is just something I ask everyone I talk to. It used to be pandemic questions, which is so depressing. So we've talked a lot about sci-fi. Do you like sci-fi movies or books?
I like books better, I think. It's just that I read more than I watch movies, maybe.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite science fiction books that touch on your domain of science?
That's a good question. Like microbiology. I don't really have any that come up to mind. It's funny because my husband's a novelist and he's trying to write a fantasy.
Really?
Novel. He wrote a novel that uses spores as magic system.
Oh.
He's trying to find a publisher.
That's so cool. I love it.
But yeah, whenever that comes out, I'll ping you.
So what sci-fi do you like that you've read?
Yeah, I really like N.K. Jemisin's Broken World Theories. It was super nice.
For the geologists out there.
Yep, yep. So I guess they got that one.
They did get that one.
Recently, I've been reading a more lighthearted novella called The Murderbot Diaries.
Oh, I love that. So good.
Yeah. So I think I really like that one too.
I really like that. I talked to a few roboticists. It's such an interesting field, and we're never going to get close to that in reality. But
yeah, we never get a genderless, sassy robot.
Unfortunately, no. Although maybe that's what R2 was.
Maybe so. He was pretty sassy.
Thanks, Kaito.
Thank you, Sarah.
Kaito Kikuchi is an image analyst scientist at Reveal Biosciences. You can find a link to the science article we discussed at science.org/podcast. Up next, we have a custom segment sponsored by the Icon School of Medicine. Custom Publishing Director Sean Sanders chats with Director of the Tisch Cancer Institute, Ramon Parsons, to get his views on the biggest challenges in cancer treatment today.
Hello to our podcast listeners, and welcome to this custom-sponsored interview from the Science AAAS Custom Publishing Office and brought to you by the Icon School of Medicine. My name is Sean Sanders, and I'm Director and Senior Editor for Custom Publishing at Science. I'm very pleased today to welcome Dr. Ramon Parsons, Director of the Tisch Cancer Institute at the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and Ward Coleman Chair in Cancer Research. He's also Director of Mount Sinai Cancer, Mount Sinai Health System, and Chair of the Department of Oncological Sciences at the Icon School of Medicine. He is also an internationally recognized expert in the fields of cancer genetics and signal transduction, with a focus on the P10 tumor suppressor gene. Ramon, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me, Sean.
So I'd like to start off by learning a little bit more about the Tisch Cancer Institute. Taking a big picture view, how do you think about cancer and its treatment?
Well, I think of cancer as a complicated problem, and I really sort of put it into three major buckets. The first bucket is understanding the cancer cell itself. You know, how is the cancer cell being reprogrammed? How is the epigenetic and genetic state changed to help it drive itself into that its transition to being a cancer and behaving like a cancer cell? The second bucket is understanding how the body is interacting with the cancer cell. That could be anywhere from how our immune system is reacting to the tumor cell or being reprogrammed by the tumor cell, or how our blood glucose and metabolism is in a state that could be helpful to the tumor cell to grow or inhibiting it to grow. And the third bucket is, how do we take care of patients with cancer? How do we implement the great discoveries and the new drugs to better treat patients in a fair and equitable way, and also in the best way possible for good outcomes for those patients? And also, as part of that, how do we prevent cancer from the beginning? Can we prevent it? Can we detect it early? All those different approaches can obviously improve our lives, and healthy lives are what we're looking for.
Now, I'm interested to know about the mission of the Tisch Cancer Institute. Why was it founded, and what type of research in particular is being done there?
The mission of the Tisch Cancer Institute is really to do research on cancer to either figure out how do we treat it better or figure out how we can prevent it or detect it earlier. And a lot of that mission is built in trying to understand the disease more fully. One of the things that I think a lot of people don't appreciate is how much is unknown about cancer. We don't know as much as we need to know. And then the other area I think that's important to bring up is the importance of technology and technological developments in our ability to perform this mission.
Is there something special about the Tisch Cancer Institute in the way that it operates compared to other research institutes?
We're a cancer center located in a freestanding school of medicine. We have a common mission, which is the health of patients. At the same time, we have the ability to focus on the cancer problem within the context of that general mission. We're able to do things that other places can't do because of that. Because of this focus on health, we don't have competing interests in other disciplines. And also, we're very much able to take advantage of the other kinds of disciplines in health that we can work with at Mount Sinai.
So when you think about a particular type of cancer, do you see it as a singular disease that impacts people in a similar way, or as a unique disease in each person? And how does this impact the way you might approach the development of treatments?
Sean, that's a really tough question to answer because it's really both. I think one of the things I can tell you is uniquely understanding a patient's disease is really important. If you don't have all the different knowledge bases that you need to develop a great treatment for a patient's cancer, you're going to be missing something really important and really useful for that patient. And so the unique patient angle is a really important one and something that is particularly important in patients that face advanced disease. The other way of looking at it, which is it's one disease and you aggregate data from many patients to try to understand it, is also equally essential because in order to predict how a patient's going to do on a given therapy, we have to have some precedents, some examples of how patients responded prior to their treatment. And the reason for that is we can get better outcomes and better survival with certain kinds of treatment, of course, versus others. So I would say that how these two different ways of looking at it come together is treatment evolves by bringing in this new information that is discovered from the individuals. And we identify often a recurring theme that maybe 20% of lung cancer patients, for example, have, and now allow us to design a therapy for that 20% because we see from studying the individuals how they share things in common.
Is there any research in particular that's being done at the Tisch Cancer Institute that is addressing this need for new treatments?
Yeah, absolutely. We have multiple different scientists that are attacking this problem from different perspectives. We have scientists that are using structural biology approaches to develop new agents to target well-known pathways that we know are important in cancer growth. We also have other scientists that are trying to use chemistry to develop new tools that are unprecedented in the sense that they're not simply targeting a kinase, which is a common target traditionally in cancer therapy, but trying to target other proteins that are in the tumor cell that are helping the tumor cell grow. We also have an effort to understand how the tumor cell co-opts the immune system and actually corrupts its original intent. And we're using that information to try to see how standard immunotherapies are either failing or succeeding. And by dissecting those responses in patients and also in model systems, we think we'll have a much better idea how to have new strategies to attack the tumor. Another area that we're working on that's also related to the immune system is to develop vaccines for cancer that are based on the mutated proteins that are unique to the tumor cell. These mutated proteins are a signal that the immune system normally is able to detect. One of the big problems is tumors evolve based on the therapies that are used to treat them. And tumors can really even avoid immune response if they are selected for immunotherapy. So we really ultimately need to be able to have a multi-pronged approach against this disease.
Ramon, at TCI, researchers are carrying out basic clinical and population health research. How do these focuses with their differing needs and priorities come together in a cohesive mission for preventing and treating cancer?
We're organized into four research programs. One is focused on the cancer cell. One is focused on the cancer immune system. A third program, our clinical investigation program, it's focused on treatment and response to treatment and resistance to treatment. And the last program is our population health program, focused on prevention and outcomes research and implementation research and anti-bias focused research. Ultimately, to solve a problem like a specific kind of cancer, it requires a multifaceted approach, not just treatment, not just public health awareness, not just understanding the basic underpinnings of the disease. It is, I would say, one of the most exciting aspects of cancer science to bring together a team of scientists that are working in a coordinated way, in a meaningful way, across the different scientific disciplines. This can be really the most rewarding and often lead to the most fundamental change that we're looking for. At the same time, not every day, not every situation needs that kind of effort. It depends on sort of the nature of the questions involved and the maturity of the field at the time you're asking it. So one has to be extremely competitive and put together the best teams possible to ask the question at hand and convince the peer review system that not only do you ask good, important questions, but that you have a team that can answer them.
So, Ramon, it's been a real pleasure having this opportunity to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sean.
And our thanks to the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai for sponsoring this interview. I'm Sean Sanders. Thank you for listening.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can listen to the show on the Science website at science.org/podcast or search for Science Magazine on any podcasting app. This show was edited and produced by Sarah Crespi, with production help from Podigy, Kevin McLean, and Megan Cantwell. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Looking for some career advice? Wondering how to get ahead or how to strike a better work-life balance? Visit our site to read how others are doing it. Use our individual development plan tool, access topic-specific article collections, or search for an exciting new job. Science Careers, produced by Science and AAAS, is a free website full of resources to help get the most out of your career. Visit sciencecareers.org today to get started.